It's Wednesday, December 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, President Obama defends his counterterrorism record while in office.
We're concerned about the effects of the constant bombardment on the civilian population of Aleppo.
Russia calls for talks about Syrian rebels in Aleppo. Also ahead, Italian markets and banks brace for possible upheaval. Family relationships set to music. It's all on today's International Edition. President Barack Obama has touted his counterterrorism policies for protecting Americans from multiple evolving global threats during his 8 years in office. Mr. Obama made his final major speech on national security just a short time ago at MacDill Air Force Base in the southeastern state of Florida, where he defended his counterterrorism record during a period of widespread unrest in the Middle East.
Plots directed from within Afghanistan and Pakistan have been consistently disrupted. Its leadership has been decimated. Dozens of terrorist leaders have been killed. Osama bin Laden is dead. And importantly, we've built a counterterrorism capability that can sustain this pressure against any terrorist network in South Asia that might threaten the United States of America. That was because of the work of our outstanding service members. Moreover, that early decision to strengthen our efforts in Afghanistan allowed us to build the capacity of Afghans to secure and defend their own country. So today, there are less than 10,000 American troops in Afghanistan. Instead of being in the lead against the Taliban, Americans are now supporting 320,000 Afghan security forces who are defending their communities and supporting our counterterrorism efforts.
Some counterterrorism experts contend the rise of Islamic State is an indication the Obama administration did not respond soon enough, despite the administration's success in killing key militant leaders. President-elect Donald Trump said during the campaign season Obama and former Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton were co-founders of Islamic State by accusing them of allowing the initial spread of the terrorist group. But President Obama said his administration has successfully built coalitions and collaborated with local governments to neutralize Islamic State and other terrorist groups without overextending U.S. military forces.
We surged our intelligence resources so that we could better understand the enemy. And then we took the fight to ISIL in both Iraq and Syria, not with American battalions, but with local forces backed by our equipment and our advisors, and importantly, our special forces. In that campaign, we have now hit ISIL with over 16,000 airstrikes. We have equipped and trained tens of thousands of partners on the ground. And today, the results are clear. ISIL has lost more than half its territory. ISIL has lost control of major population centers. Its morale is plummeting. Its recruitment is drying up. Its commanders and external plotters are being taken out, and local populations are turning against it.
The president cautioned the United States will never be fully immune from the effects of terrorism, pointing to relatively small attacks carried out in the past few years as hateful ideologies on the internet radicalize some individuals. But Mr. Obama said he is working to keep the broad framework of his policies intact after he leaves office in January. It's time now for us to check out what's buzzing on the web. And to do that, International Edition's social media reporter G. Abby Lee joins me here in the studio. Hi, G, and what do you have for us?
Hi, Jim. It's an interesting day to mull over the Obama administration's East Asia policy, better known as the pivot to Asia, especially in the terms of business relations. First, let's take a look at two tweets from President-elect Donald Trump. He tweeted, "Masa, SoftBank of Japan," referring to Masayoshi Son of SoftBank, "of Japan has agreed to invest $50 billion in the U.S. toward businesses and 50,000 new jobs. Masayoshi said he would have never done this had we, Trump, not won the election. Trump made a joint announcement with the Korean-Japanese CEO of SoftBank, Masayoshi Son, Tuesday at the Trump Tower. And to tell you a little bit about Son, he's the founder and CEO of the SoftBank Group and the chairman of American telecom provider Sprint. Not surprisingly, he's the second richest man in Japan.
Okay, well, that looks like a pretty positive development at first glance. What's the reaction like from internet users?
Yeah, so Trump supporters are touting the possible job creation and investment on American soil, but financial reporters and writers have something a little different to say, or tweet in this instance. Here is one from Alec Ross, the author of New York Times bestseller, The Industries of the Future. Translation: under Donald Trump's FCC, referring to Federal Communications Commission, Masayoshi will be able to merge Sprint with another wireless carrier. And it appears that the other carrier will likely be T-Mobile because the number of jobs Masayoshi pledges to create in the U.S. is 50,000, which is the same number of T-Mobile employees.
Okay, well, the math is interesting. What else happens to be trending?
Another story that can impact the U.S.-Asia relations in the same sector. In an 8-0 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court favored South Korean electronics giant Samsung in a patent suit with American tech company Apple. That means Samsung will have to pay less on a smartphone infringement of a design patent to Apple. And Twitter users are calling it a big win for Samsung. Jim?
All right. Thank you so much, G. You can follow our program's account either on your Samsung or your Apple by following Twitter at @VOA_IE. I'm also out there at VOA Stevenson, and G is at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia. No, quote, smoking gun was uncovered at South Korean presidential scandal hearing. Thousands mourn popular Indian politician and actress. Indonesia gang rape, latest in string of horrifying cases. Philippine marine sanctuary in disputed sea risks upsetting China. Japan's Prime Minister Abe says he will not apologize while visiting Pearl Harbor. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website and via our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Russia said it plans to hold talks with the United States this week in Geneva on a rebel withdrawal from the embattled Syrian city of Aleppo, even as Moscow and China on Monday vetoed a United Nations Security Council resolution to impose a week-long ceasefire to facilitate humanitarian aid to trapped civilians. U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner said Monday he had nothing to confirm on a meeting with Russian diplomats.
The basic challenge is the same, which is how do we meet Russia and by extension the regime's concerns about Nusra in Aleppo. At the same time, we bring about a credible cessation of hostilities in Aleppo, even a pause in the fighting, frankly, whereby we can get much needed humanitarian assistance in. And by that, I mean foodstuffs, medical care, et cetera. But the challenge is the same. I mean, it's, you know, you've got Russia very concerned about Nusra's presence. At the same time, we're concerned about the effects on the constant bombardment on the civilian population of Aleppo. And we're also adamant that while Nusra is there and is an element of this, that there's a moderate Syrian opposition that should not and does not deserve to be bombed into submission.
At the Security Council, Russian Ambassador Vitaly Churkin argued a ceasefire in Aleppo would only allow the rebels time to fortify their positions and replenish their ammunition. He insisted Security Council action should be postponed while the U.S.-Russian talks take place. Anthony Billingsley is a Mideast analyst at Australia's University of New South Wales, and he spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty.
The problem has been all along that there's been calls for a ceasefire. The Russians have said, yes, we'll agree to a ceasefire, but then have only agreed to a very short space of time, which the UN has repeatedly said is inadequate for the resupply of the civilians in that part of Aleppo. So we're now into sort of rerunning this sort of argument to an extent. Some of the aspects of this resolution, you know, in themselves are fine, a seven-day ceasefire, which would then be renewed depending on circumstances, the provision of aid, which the UN said has been ready to go for quite a long time, and the beginning of talks. And I think this is an indication that the US has now abandoned any idea of replacing Bashar al-Assad, that he is now clearly recognized as part of the equation, at least in the short term. The other issue that's come up in this draft resolution is the idea of separating terrorists from armed opposition. And it's very hard to know exactly what anyone really means by that, because the only really effective fighting forces in Aleppo appear to have been extremist groups such as the Jabhat al-Nusra, which has just rebadged itself. When the rebels temporarily broke through the siege of Aleppo a few weeks ago, it was these groups that led the attacks. So it's pretty hard to see how you're going to separate genuine armed opposition from extremist groups.
There is a possible effort by Canada, according to the Associated Press, to present some sort of cessation of hostilities in Aleppo to the 193-member General Assembly, although this has no force. What signal would this send if it is approved?
So this is actually quite potentially a very significant act. Now, the Canadian initiative is very much focused purely on the humanitarian situation in Aleppo. It's not looking beyond that. But there is a concept called Uniting for Peace, which was first introduced early on in the UN's history and has been applied 20 or 30 times since, where if the Security Council is not acting, meeting its responsibility to pursue international peace and security, the General Assembly can take on the role.
Anthony Billingsley doubts any United Nations action will deter Russian-backed forces from completing their objective of taking the rebel-held sector of Aleppo. The resignation of Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi following Sunday's no vote in a referendum on constitutional change has dealt yet another political blow to the European Union. Fears are now growing that the political uncertainty could worsen and the chronic problems of Italian banks and spread to other parts of Europe. But many analysts say the referendum result was about domestic issues and markets have given a muted response to the upheaval. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Several Italian banks were struggling with bad loans well before Sunday's referendum. Analysts put the total figure at $390 billion. Banca Monte dei Paschi di Siena, which claims to be the world's oldest bank, planned to raise $5.4 billion in capital. Now, those investments are in jeopardy and the bank could be nationalised. Luigi Scazzieri of the Centre for European Reform says there is hope that investors will not be put off.
In the immediate term, they might find it slightly more difficult to raise capital, which they need to cover their bad loans. However, nothing has really changed in the banking situation since the situation previous to the referendum.
Italy's borrowing costs have risen since Sunday's vote, but Europe is better able to prevent a repeat of the 2008 euro debt crisis, according to Yves Bertoncini of the Paris-based analyst group the Jacques Delors Institute.
The EU is more equipped to face a possible problem in Italy that it was 5 years ago. We have an ECB playing its role. We have a European stability mechanism able to rescue Italy if needed.
Prime Minister Renzi will remain in power until Parliament passes the 2017 budget. The President has said he will avoid calling immediate elections, but the political uncertainty could turn market sentiment against Italy, says Giovanni Orsina of Luis Guido Carli University in Rome.
All'incertezza rispetto all'assetto della Costituzione, della legge elettorale.
Orsina says the troubles over the Constitution and the electoral laws now add to the uncertainty over the government. So, he adds, one can say that Italy overall is entering a period of uncertainty. The opposition Five Star Movement, which tops opinion polls, is demanding immediate elections and a vote on leaving the euro. But analyst Luigi Scancieri says fears that Italy will exit the single currency are overplayed, as new electoral laws will most likely deliver a coalition government.
The new law, crucially, is going to be based on a proportional system, most likely. And such a system is going to make it extremely hard for single parties such as the Five Star Movement to gain power at the next elections. But, of course, they are calling for a referendum on the euro. The small matter is that this is actually unconstitutional.
The hope in Italy and Europe, analysts say, is that a smooth political transition will help avoid a stormy end to a year of upheaval. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You'll find much more on this story and many others at our website. That's voanews.com. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. And while you're online, check out our Facebook page. It's VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. A popular Danish group has released a new song about family relationships. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London tells International Edition's Sarah Williams about the new single.
The Grammy nominations were announced this past week, and in the Song of the Year and Record of the Year category, you'll find newcomers Lucas Graham. This is a band that comes from Copenhagen and put out their first album in 2012, but the new album, which is called The Blue Album, was released last year. And with it came the big hit 7 Years, and that's the song that's in the Record of the Year, Song of the Year category, going against Beyonce and Rihanna and all the regulars you'd expect to be in those big categories. Now, Lucas Graham are actually led by a guy whose name is Lucas Graham Forchhammer.
And okay.
He's the lead singer. He became a father this year for the first time. Very nice guy. They are a very soft-spoken group of guys and love their sound, love their style. Now, Lucas Graham Forchhammer, who wrote most of the music, said that the album and the songs on the new album, the Blue Album, are inspired by his relationship with his father. And if you listen to the lyrics of 7 Years, it's a very touching song, and it's a tribute to the memories that he shared with his dad. And his fond memories at age 7, because if, you know, you put the song together, 7 years. The second one was a hit called Mama Said. But today we're going to listen to the third single from their album. This is brand new from Lucas Graham, and it's a song called You're Not There.
I only got you in my stories, and you know I tell them right. I remember you and I when I'm awake at night. So give it up for fallen glory. I never got to say goodbye. I wish I could ask for just a bit more time.
All right, well, Larry, what's the background to this song? Why did they write this?
Well, all of the songs on the album are inspired by relationships. Most of them are Lucas Graham Forchhammer's relationship with his father. And that was the story behind the success of the song 7 Years. He became a dad this year. Lucas Graham had his first child. And this is all about relationships with his girlfriend. They haven't yet wed. With his new baby at home. With the father who passed away. And his relationship with his mother as well. The song is called You're Not There. And it talks about the fact that he misses his father. And his father was not around for much of his success, much of his life later on. This is the band's second album, and obviously Dad passed away even before the first album came out. It was a number of years ago. So it's a very heartfelt, very sensitive, very emotional album. And the songs are all kind of autobiographical, very true and inspired by Lucas Graham Forchheimer's relationship with his now-deceased father. And it's earned him, as I mentioned earlier, several Grammy nominations, but that's not it. He also was nominated for quite a few MTV awards in Europe and in the United States as well. So they are a hot band to watch. They're one of the newcomers on the music scene here in the United States.
Are they touring?
They are on tour right now, as a matter of fact, in the U.S., and I've got a request in for an interview. So hopefully that'll come through and I'll be able to feature them on Border Crossings. But for now, we get their music and we get to enjoy the sound of Lucas Graham.
Thanks very much. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. You're not.
It's such a cool show. Be sure to check it out every week at voanews.com. And while you're online, follow us on Twitter at voa_IE. We tweet out a lot of great stuff each and every day. You don't want to miss it. VOA Now is our Facebook page. Stop by there as well. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jimmy Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. Thank you so much for taking part of your day to be with us. Have a great day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
While military success against violent extremists is essential to security, it isn't enough to ensure that the terrorist threat will not just regroup, reconstitute, and resurface in the future. At the heart of countering violent extremism, said U.S. Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights Sarah Sewell, is the recognition that military defeat of today's terrorists is not sufficient to kill the ideology or address the broader factors needed to prevent new terrorists from emerging. In essence, CVE seeks to prevent the next generation of threats by helping the most vulnerable people and places resist terrorist recruitment and expansion. One aspect of this approach is to promote good governance and halt state policies that fan radicalization to violence. When governments fail to protect their citizens and respect human rights, they breed anger and resentments that violent extremists exploit. Examples abound. Boko Haram gained traction after Nigerian security forces suppressed peaceful protests and executed the group's founder, Mohamed Yusuf, without trial. Al-Shabaab exploits heavy-handed tactics by Kenyan security forces to win over new recruits. And in Afghanistan, the Taliban rails against government corruption to replenish fighters each year. How governments treat their citizens has a profound impact on the scope of terrorist threats. A second critical component of CVE is to build the resilience of vulnerable communities in which local leaders, parents, and peers know how to spot and address signs of terrorist radicalization, in which mentors or institutions can offer powerful counterarguments or provide alternative paths for those at risk. Where communities build such resilience, terrorist groups will struggle to find new followers and safe havens. The U.S. supports networks of women and girls around the world, including in South Asia, to act when they see signs of terrorist radicalization in their neighborhoods. The United States helped establish the Strong Cities Network to connect mayors and local leaders across the globe to exchange what works and what doesn't in stifling terrorist recruitment. Even as Daesh is losing ground and fighters on the battlefield, it is critical to remember that preventing the next generation of terrorists is every bit as important as defeating the current threat.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.